I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. I just wanted to let you know that this episode of Vermont Edition has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Skylar White just graduated from Green Mountain Union High School. During her high school days, she says she was raped by a classmate who she's known since kindergarten. For many young women, coming forward doesn't feel like an option, but Skylar wanted not only to press charges, but to be vocal about her story.
It's really hard for people to say they were raped. It's not just that you regret having sex with someone, it's that it was never talked about, you didn't want to, you were locked in a room and didn't have any other choice, you were being egged on. It's all rape, but we don't want to call it rape because that's a scary word. I feel like that's so much of why people don't come forward, is because they don't think that's what happened to them, but they're still going through the same phases of grief and pain and shame at the same time. Yeah.
That was Skylar White, a recent graduate of Green Mountain Union High School. When VPR reporter Howard Weiss-Tisman did a story about Skylar, a lot of the comments that came in response focused on this question of consent. What is consent? How is it given? How is it defined? That prompted us to think there might be an opening for a discussion on that topic. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to have that conversation. I'm joined in the studio by Kathleen Barkley, Executive Director of HopeWorks. HopeWorks provides crisis counseling and advocacy for people who've been affected by sexual violence. Hi, Kathleen. Nice to have you back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. And we're also joined today by Kay Burdo, a freelance writer for Bustle, which is an online women's magazine. Kay, it's nice to have you on the program as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this legal definition of consent first, because there's a lot more to this conversation than just what legally defines consent. But as I said, this often comes up in sexual assault and rape cases. What's the legal definition of assault? Is there a standard definition that cuts across all states and all different kinds of situations, Kathleen?
There's not a standard definition, and many states have some pretty big differences in their consent laws. I was reading about North Carolina, and they're wrangling with the problem that their consent law, if somebody consents initially to sexual activity, that can't be revoked. So that's a loophole in their law that they're grappling with right now. So each state is different, but we like to think that we can still have a conversation about what it looks like in our relationships.
Well, how do you define it?
So we define it as continuous, enthusiastic yes. And that's how we consider consent to be ideally given in a relationship.
Kay, what would you say? How would you define consent?
Yeah, I think that consent is at its base level just permission to engage in sexual activity. And that is hopefully enthusiastic and is absolutely required to be ongoing. I think consent also applies to non-sexual situations and touching generally.
So, yeah, I mean, as I said, we talk about rape and sexual assault, but this idea of consent goes way beyond that, because even something that may not stand up in court can certainly be a coerced situation, an uncomfortable situation, a regretted situation. And so this idea of consent is not one that just applies to whether or not someone is sexually assaulted, okay? It's about engaging in activities that are pleasant and pleasurable and comfortable and wonderful, ideally, for both or as many parties as are involved, not just one that doesn't constitute sexual assault.
Right. And that's something that I've written about before, where it's really important that we take the conversation beyond just is it assault to how do we express pleasure and how do we get what we want out of the situation that's happening, because we're there to have needs met and to be there with other people. And we should have that in a way that is safe.
Kathleen, when I was a teenager and on through, there was the saying, no means no. And that was really out there in the media. No means no. And so that's pretty much ingrained in everybody's heads.
Right.
Now we often hear yes means yes. Mm-hmm. But is that all we're thinking? It just has to be a yes? Is that it? Just get it from your partner and you're good to go?
I think there's much more to the conversation. So sometimes consent is verbal and you hear a verbal yes, but there are many ways that we communicate that are nonverbal. And I think it's really key that communication happen in relationships, which can be tricky, you know, in a situation where maybe someone is less familiar with their sexual partner. If it's a one-time experience with this partner, then knowing their nonverbal cues might be very hard. So I think that constant communication is key.
So what does that look like, though, in practice? And you know, I think we can without getting too graphic, really get into this here, because mm-hmm. what does it actually mean to have nonverbal consent? Because what I think you are saying to me with nonverbal consent may not be what you think you're conveying to me in the moment. So are we talking about sounds? Are we talking about movement, active participation? I mean, Kay, give us some ideas for what verbal and nonverbal consent might look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you want to talk about nonverbal consent, a really good space to look in is the kink community, because there's a lot of situations in which people can't verbally consent, whether it's because they're in subspace or they're gagged or any number of situations where they just don't have that capability. On top of which, of course, there's some people with disabilities and such like that. So you can create a signal of some sort that is either one that you have to continue engaging in. So one thing to do is you can hold a handkerchief, and if you drop it, then that means you need to be done, that you're rescinding consent or mm-hmm. giving a red, as we would call it, or something in the opposite direction that you nod or you do something to give that signal. So there's definitely a lot of nonverbal ways. I mean, and verbal ways, I've been with my partner for over 9 years, one of my partners, and she will still ask me if she can hug me sometimes or just casually touch me. And it creates a basis in our relationship where I always know that the answer can be no. And because we practice that engagement, we can feel like it's a safe thing and not a weird question.
You've brought up an interesting part of this conversation, because so often it seems like when we have conversations about consent, it's about initial sexual encounters or sexual encounters between and among people who maybe haven't had sex before or haven't been intimate before. And so, Kathleen, there's this conversation about, like, as if you can get consent one time and then you know you have it for good, and you know you and your partner or partners are sort of good for that to the rest of your relationship.
Right.
Is consent something we should be actively soliciting from our partners throughout a relationship?
Absolutely. And, you know, back in the 80s, the rape laws from state to state had what they called a marital exception in them, which meant that it was legally impossible to rape your spouse. And that was based on this assumption that once you were married or partnered, that you always had consent to have sex with someone. And so that has changed, luckily. I still think we have some cultural norms around that. And I think that that will certainly take time to change. But I think that having that continuous conversation with your partner can only strengthen and deepen your relationship over time. And it becomes normal. It doesn't become awkward. Mm-hmm. So I think that only good things can come from that.
Yeah, Kay, you were talking about how the idea can be, you know, even within a long-term relationship, you may be asking consent. And that may not be an explicit verbal question mm-hmm. that, you know, delineates exactly what we're going to do this evening. But it could right. be, you know, even just to like, so you want to, you know, and you,
yeah,
you might
and
know
it,
your
it can
language.
Be sexy that way, right? Like it can be flirty and fun and it's sort of, you know, its own fun part of foreplay when you take it to that level and you don't make it a forced, awkward conversation. And I think it's really hard to – I think the other thing is how do we ask for no's or how do we ask people and allow them to give space – or give them space to say no? And then how do we receive no's gracefully and give them gracefully? And I think that's really hard. And I think that's one thing that as you do this more and more, you get really used to it. And it's a lot easier to say, you know – I don't know that I want to do that today. Maybe let's do this instead. Or I'm not really feeling up for it. And then, you know, you can say something like, well, I'm disappointed because I was hoping we could do this. But you know what? I'm really glad you set a boundary with me and I really appreciate you taking care of yourself. And there's a lot of ways that you can talk about it that just allow the conversation to happen and it becomes totally, as my partner early said, de-weirdified. So
you have a couple of great graphics in the article that you wrote for Bustle, and we'll link to it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, where you do offer graceful ways to say no and graceful ways to accept no. So, you know, it might even be something like, I don't love that idea, but I still love you. It's not, you know, it's not you. It's just not going to happen tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bitsy is calling in from Barrie. Hi, Bitsy. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just saw recently this documentary called The Hunting Ground on Netflix. And, you know, I find it fascinating that this idea that the onus is often put on the women, you know, did you fight back? Did you say no? You know, were you clear about how you responded to send that message, when it's very little responsibility is put on, in heterosexual relationships, on the man, especially in a college setting? You know, did you ask? You know, every day on our computers it says, are you sure you want to delete this file? And we say yes. You know, it should really be the responsibility. We should be teaching our boys that they have to ask, and they're responsible, because oftentimes in a sexual situation where a woman starts to feel threatened and afraid, she freezes up and she can't articulate what's happening because of trauma. And so for the responsibility to be put on her in a traumatic situation is totally unfair. And in this documentary, it was just amazing how these women were victimized, put on the stand, and then the young college boys were set free every time. So it's just really, really frustrating.
Bitsy, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your thoughts. Kathleen, what do you think about what Bitsy's talking about there?
Yeah, I appreciate her in particular bringing up the idea of freezing. You know, when we think about trauma, we think of flight or fright, flight, and we forget about freeze, which is a natural response to trauma. And a lot of times that's misinterpreted in the legal system as consent, when it was not. It was a natural reaction to trauma. And victims really struggle with that. I didn't fight back. I didn't scream. And unfortunately, the legal system sometimes can chew them up through that process.
What about this idea of gender roles, too? Because I think, you know, often in a conversation about consent, whether it's being taught on college campuses or in sex ed classes or in conversations like this, there is either an implicit or explicit assumption that what we're talking about in terms of the person who should be soliciting a yes in a sexual encounter, we're talking about a heterosexual relationship, and we're talking about a man, because the man is dominant. And there's this sort of assumption that, you know, if the man is going to get what he wants, he needs to get a yes from his female partner. And right. That seems to me like, first of all, such a heteronormative assumption, but mm-hmm. also really perpetuating gender roles and this idea that the female in a heterosexual partnership shouldn't be the one saying, is this okay? Can I touch you here? Do you want to go further? Or God right. forbid, don't touch me here, touch me here. Yes, this is what I like. I don't like that. Does this sort of perpetuate gender norms when we have a conversation about consent that is consent that men need to get?
Yeah, absolutely. And it plays into this gender stereotype that women are the gatekeepers. If sexual activity is going to happen, that women sort of hold the key in heterosexual relationships to that happening or not happening, which I think does a disservice to everyone. So I'm seeing things change in subtle ways over time in terms
you
of
are?
our prevention education work. I think young men in particular really want to talk about consent. And I think a lot of them have very good intentions behind that, that they know that this is an issue. And many of them haven't been brought up or socially conditioned. And so they're confused about this issue in a lot of ways. And some of them, you know, are really hungry for this information and for the dialogue around it. So I'm remaining hopeful. I think there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely, it enforces gender roles. I think the flip side to that is that the majority of cases of this stuff happening, of assault, is happening in one direction. And I think that that's where the focus comes from. However, as a queer person, I, of course, really want to see these depictions get further. And especially with men, I taught my brother's 15, and we had that conversation about consent, not just about him with women, and explaining to him, like, you know, how women are socialized not to say no, and, you know, like, that he needs to be very careful, but also with his consent, especially around peer pressure and friends and, you know, teenage boys being like, oh, well, you know, you must be gay if you didn't, kind of stuff, and about how his consent matters too. So I think that the conversations are starting to open up more, and people are having those conversations and recognizing the gender stuff. And I think, you know, it's really important that the conversation does move beyond it. But I think it's important to recognize why that might be.
Yeah, absolutely. But if we don't teach young women about getting consent, it suggests to them that they are never or should never be the ones that are initiating various steps in that sexual relationship.
Absolutely. And that is totally a part that needs to be, you know, moved way beyond where it is currently. And I do see a lot more of that happening. I feel like, especially in queer communities, you see a lot more of conversations around consent happening, which I think was really missing from the picture for a while. I think those depictions were totally missing.
Let's go to Ben, who's calling in from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I recently had an opportunity to hear a talk from Dr. Jenna Nichols Curtis down at SUNY Cortland. And, you know, she has been doing a lot of research on how college age people understand consent. And what they determined that I thought was pretty interesting is that, you know, a lot of times they're looking at, you know, as you said, you know, they often don't know that what they've been through is sexual assault or rape, because they think of it as unwanted sex, whether it's from, you know, their, you know, if they have, you know, their own personal pressures that they're putting on themselves, that's one thing. But to have the peer pressure and coercion from their sexual partner, you know, the repeated requests and, you know, and nagging at them until they give in, you know, giving in obviously is not consent, but they don't really see it that way. And even alcohol and drugs, you know, people who were, you know, raped while they were unconscious from alcohol, you know, don't consider that a rape, unfortunately. So, you know, having that, you know, it's not just physical force that we're talking about, but, you know, all these other things go into, you know, your consent, and that's not really how the young people are thinking about that.
Ben, I appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much for sharing it. Let's get one in here again before the break. Natalie is calling in from Wheelock. Hi, Natalie. What are you thinking?
Well, I have two comments. My first comment is that I have been on both sides of the issue, one being raped and also being accused of rape. I think communication, as your guest said, it's key. I think that if you are not able to have the conversation about sex, that you should not be having it.
Yeah, Natalie, I appreciate that. When you say if you can't have the conversation about sex, do you mean verbal? Are you talking about verbal consent?
I believe it has to be verbal. I think that people read the body expression differently, especially if it's, like you had said, a one-night stand or just in the beginning. And later in relationships, I've been in one for about 5 years. Sometimes, you know, I want it to be nonverbal because I don't want to offend my partner, but it has to be verbal so there are no mistakes.
Natalie, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective with us today. Thank you for that. Kay, you had said earlier that there are situations where you can develop a signal that's nonverbal, mm-hmm. or if you are unable to give verbal consent, depending on what your situation is, whether you are somebody who's nonverbal to begin with or you're in a sexual situation that involves not being able to speak that is fully consensual, mm-hmm. that there still has to be a way with your partner or partners to say, yes, this is good or no, this is not good. So, you know, how do you do that with that understanding that sometimes nonverbal consent can be misconstrued?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to note that this strategy can also work for people with trauma who potentially might, in situations like that, have a freeze response where they can't, or like they can't verbally express it for some reason. I know that can be really hard for people sometimes. So the key there is to create a symbol that is unmistakably that. And to always default to assuming that if anything remotely like that signal is given, that you need to check in, right? You err on the side of caution and you do something, like I said, like the handkerchief trick, right? Like you're holding it and you have to actively continue to choose to hold it.
So it's not just a flirtatious, you know, eyes. It's not open to interpretation. It is nonverbal, but it is a hard and fast signal.
Absolutely. Just like you would with a safe word. It's a safe symbol.
We're talking about consent today and how it plays out in sexual situations. We're hearing from many of you about how you conceptualize this, how you put it into practice as well, what you think the importance of consent is, and how do you define it in real life? Judah says, I think in many cases, consent should include reasonable levels of clear thinking. Judgment can easily be impaired, and not just by chemicals, but by situations where someone hasn't really given thought to their decision. Blythe in Rutland says, the biggest problem our species suffers from is lack of communication. Sex shouldn't happen until all disease and baby-making contingencies have been discussed and agreed upon. Then you have to get into if now is good, what each of the individuals enjoy, and what they don't want to do. Talk. No one is a mind reader. One of the things that happens frequently now on college campuses is an idea of affirmative consent and policies that schools have sometimes put in place that says if students want to have sex on campus, they need to be engaging in affirmative consent. In some cases, throughout the sexual process, you need to get consent from your partners. One of the people who started that movement was Bethany Saltman. She was part of a group called the Women of Antioch, who helped create the affirmative consent policy at Antioch College in the early 90s. And she joins us on the line now. Bethany, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So when you were at Antioch and you started working on this issue, was that what you were advocating for from the start, a policy of affirmative consent that partners needed to get to a yes from their sexual partners?
You know, the term affirmative consent, I only heard that recently. At the time, we weren't thinking about it that way. We wanted the administration to kick rapists off campus. That was our original intent. And with that came the policy that became what's now known as affirmative consent. So the idea that we wanted people to be able to build a consensual relationship during sex, that just kind of came out of nowhere. We were very clear that we wanted the administration's attention that these rapes were happening on campus, and then we decided that we needed to do something to protect ourselves from future offenses.
So did this policy work for you? Did you feel like that was a good outcome from what you were advocating for?
Yeah. It was great.
How does it actually work? Explain affirmative consent if this is a new concept to people.
It's interesting. I've been listening to the show, and it's basically what everybody's talking about, which nobody talked about before. So before we did what we did in the 90s, as far as I knew, asking for consent during sex was ridiculous. And it was all supposed to be nonverbal. You're supposed to vibe it out. And a rape was something super explicit, violent, and obvious. And anything below that, was considered, tough luck, kind of. So affirmative consent is really no different from this entire conversation of just having respect for the fact that both parties need to be able to understand that the other person says yes, however you do it, verbally, non-verbally, with a handkerchief. Partners need to figure out how to communicate, as one of the callers said, with one another. And it's really that simple. And before we came up with this policy that was so radical, that was really not in the conversation about sex.
You know, there's still an argument that says, first of all, this is completely unenforceable for colleges to have a policy that requires affirmative consent. They're not in the bedrooms. They're not involved in student sexual encounters. So how can they have a policy requiring this? Unenforceable.
Right.
But also, that it is unrealistic, that people aren't necessarily going to say, can I take off your pants? Can I do this now? So how do you see the value of having a policy like this in a place like a college campus?
Well, the enforcement issue, and I told the producer before I came on, I don't feel like I can really speak to that. I'm not sure how colleges are enforcing that and how, quote, enforceable it is by law. Now, from a communications point of view, I think it's absolutely necessary and completely useful to have this policy in place because it's a way of changing our minds. We are imperfect beings, and the law is an imperfect rule, and the courts, as we know, are incredibly imperfect. But what we're doing is we're moving the needle, and we're changing the nature of the conversation to create. I mean, just the fact that this is now the conversation, to me, is success. Again, I can't speak to whether or not people are being, how this is working out in courts of law or college campuses. But clearly this is working because we're already disseminating this idea that it's possible for people to come to some understanding of a consensual relationship, sexually, with hugs. Anytime a person gets touched. I mean, when we said this in the 90s, not only were our peers you know, pretty shocked and thinking we were crazy, but we were lampooned and ridiculed publicly, nationally. And now, you know, the first time I heard about this, it was when President Obama was talking about affirmative consent, and I could not believe that it had gotten to that point, because when we talked about it in the 90s, it was just outrageous and completely a fringe concept.
Yeah, didn't Saturday Night Live make fun of you for having this policy?
Yeah, right. That's been my claim to fame.
Do you use affirmative consent in sexual encounters? Do you have any tips for people for whom this may be an uncomfortable concept?
I think that I absolutely use it. I've been married for, 16 years, and 100%. I mean, it's just, who would ever want to have a relationship where you weren't agreeing upon sex? It's just, unfathomable to me, which doesn't mean that you can't play, but, like one of the guests said earlier, you have to have some ground rules. I mean, we're grown-ups here, so absolutely. And in terms of tips, I really think that it's a matter of how we understand sexuality and our power. And when we empower ourselves to listen to another person, I think so many of us have never had the experience of how actually thrilling that is. And so this is an invitation to get really in touch with another person in such a deep and profound way. And it doesn't mean that there isn't mystery and incredible trust that can grow out of that. But to start at this kind of ground zero of building trust with another person is a beautiful thing and a difficult, complicated thing, granted. But my tip would be to just, think about what would that be like to imagine a world where you're actually able to have the freedom to play with another person because they want you to. And what would that be like?
Bethany Saltman, I appreciate that. As Kay Burdo's partner says, you can de-weirdify it if you just make it part of your life. Appreciate your thoughts on that. Bethany Saltman was one of the women of Antioch who helped create this affirmative consent policy at Antioch College in the early 90s. She's also a writer, editor, and researcher far beyond, her claim to fame for Saturday Night Live in the 90s. Bethany, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about consent today. We'd love your perspective on this. 800-639-2211 is our number. You can email vermontedition@vpr.net, or you can engage in this conversation on our Facebook page or at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Let's go to Lola calling in from Burlington. Hi, Lola. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Lola, and I am I've been doing consent training and workshops for quite a long time, and starting in something called Cuddle Party. And I wanted to make an observation that I think there's a very important distinction between permission versus agreement. Permission carries with it a kind of one-way or one-sidedness in a lot of contexts, and several of your callers, and I think both of your panelists, have both mentioned the idea that this is deeply enculturated, that there's a lot of implicit understanding about when it's okay and when you do and do not have to ask. I think that's especially true in relationships. I'm a relationship coach, and this is a really common problem. I think that one of the questions that I always try to encourage people in workshops and clients to do, to ask themselves, is this very simple question of, who is it for? Starting with that question, if somebody, just take a simple example of a hug. If someone asks you if you would like a hug, that answer in a general social setting, if you're in a party, for example, I think all of us have had this experience. You walk into a party and suddenly there are people that you know, some people you don't know, and somebody walks up to you that you sort of know and says, hey, how about a hug? Or worse, just opens their arms with the expectation that it will happen. Being able to ask yourself, who is it for, can be a good way to examine what interest and motive is, because motive is part of this.
Lola, I really appreciate your thoughts on that. And you bring up an interesting thing here, which is that this idea of consent goes beyond sexual encounters. And we're talking about physical consent or consent to physical activities, especially right now. But your thought about, you know, if you're in a party and somebody gives you a hug, that's not comfortable to everybody. Not everybody is a hugger. Or, you know, we think about children and how we teach consent to small children when we're not talking about sex necessarily. And for example, with my 3-year-old, we try to tell him, you can tell us to stop tickling you and we have to stop. So if you say no, we stop tickling you. And then it does become a game where he'll say, stop. Okay, go. Stop. So, you know, how do you think, Kathleen and Kay, I'll get your thoughts on this too. How do we sort of enculturate this idea of consent and bodily autonomy?
It's a great point. I think that we need to start as parents. We have to work with our kids when they're little around this and not force them to give a kiss to grandma, say, for example, if they don't want to do that, because it's sending this awful message that they don't have a right to say no and they don't have power over their own bodies and their own pleasure. And so I think that that is absolutely key to shifting the tide and also helping to reduce incidences of childhood sexual abuse. That's one of the key ways that we can reduce kids' risks for childhood sexual abuse is to have these conversations early and often.
What do you think, Kay? Ideas about teaching it in general, but also to what Lola was talking about, you know, encounters that we have throughout our lives that are physical that aren't necessarily with a sexual partner.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it took me until well into my adulthood to realize that I could say no to hugs that sort of proliferate the Burlington liberal arts community, you know, which is where I've spent most of my life. And, you know, I love the people around, but I'm not a very physical person outside of my partners. It's interesting. I have my former stepdaughter is 7 or 8 now, and I spent her early years really harping on, you know, consent with her in a very child appropriate, very age appropriate way around nobody gets to touch you if you don't want them to, including, you know, me and your mom. Like, you know, nobody, if you don't want to give somebody a hug, you don't have to do that. You know, I mean, aside from obviously very direct safety issues. And now when I went to visit last year, you know, we were fooling around in the living room and I went to touch the tulle on her shirt. And she said, no, I don't want you to touch my shirt. And I said, okay, that's cool. And a few minutes later, she asked me if she could tickle me. And so she tickled me and I said, can I tickle you back? And she said, yes, but I want you to tickle me here. And was very clear not only about what she didn't want to happen, but was very clear about what she did want to happen. And honestly, most people I know in their 20s can't verbalize that in that way. So I think, you know, the earlier you start, and, you know, somebody earlier said starting at ground zero, I think ground zero is childhood. I really do. I think from a very, very young age, you know, I have a friend who, you know, she even every time they go to the doctor, she explains to her child what is happening. And the doctor works with her and talks through it with her, you know, 1.5-year-old, because it's really important from an early age to show that you respect their autonomy and that they can say no and, you know, you always have to override for safety reasons. Obviously, you're not going to let your kid run in the street just because they don't want to get picked up. But with that balance of really respecting that they are tiny people that really understand what feels good and doesn't feel good to them and what they do and do not want to do.
We're talking about consent today, and obviously this conversation goes all the way from childhood through sexual encounters, through marriage and long-term partnerships. And this concept of what is consent, how do we think about it in our real lives is what we're exploring. A few years ago, a video started circulating in social media circles, even on some official police accounts, that tried to offer a simple way to think about sexual consent.
If you're still struggling with consent, just imagine instead of initiating sex, you're making them a cup of tea. You say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they go, oh my God, I would love a cup of tea. Thank you. Then you know they want a cup of tea. If you say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they're like, you know, I'm not really sure. Then you can make them a cup of tea or not, but be aware that they might not drink it. And if they don't drink it, then, and this is the important bit, don't make them drink it. Just because you made it doesn't mean you're entitled to watch them drink it. And if they say, no thank you, then don't make them tea at all. Just don't make them tea. Don't make them drink tea. Don't get annoyed at them for not wanting tea. They just don't want tea, okay?
Seems simple enough. Cue all the think pieces about how consent is not like a cup of tea. It's like a piece of cake, or it's more nuanced or whatever. And that's all true. But here was a video being shared again and again that talked about consent, offering it an albeit cutesy way to open a dialogue about a subject people don't usually post about on their Facebook wall. We're talking about consent today with Kathleen Barkley from HopeWorks and with writer Kay Burdo. And you call 800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Jacob is calling in from Milton. Hi, Jacob. Go ahead.
I was just making a comment about, I heard you earlier, about marriage. Well, I'm a millennial and my wife, and, you know, I've joked with her saying, you know, we're married, so it's not rape. But I've just, you know, I heard that comment come up, as I'm sure that's happened before, but I just think that if you're in a healthy relationship that, you know, I mean, you would not take advantage of your spouse. I mean, or have even said the term pity sex. If you're in a healthy relationship, I don't think you would do that. I mean, I certainly wouldn't, and I'm sure a lot of other people wouldn't either. So I think the whole consent part, especially if you're in a relationship, is should be very open and aware of the fact that your partner is consenting or not consenting.
So, Jacob, for you, even in a marriage, I mean, it sounds like you and your wife have jokes, but what you're talking about is knowing your partner and knowing whether or not they're into what you're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the consequences of, you know, proceeding to do anything else would definitely be detrimental to your relationship, in my opinion.
Jacob, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Let's get another one in here from Mike in Newport. Hi, Mike. Thanks for waiting.
Howdy.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. What do you think?
Good. We've been talking about pre-consent and then active consent during. One thing I always have liked, and my partner and I, 20 years, is post, just gratitude, saying, you know, thanks. Even if it's a kiss or a hug, it's just nice to know that what we did for each other was mutually appreciated. And so it also just sets up a thought process about, did I like what happened, and yes or no. So,
Mike, it doesn't feel for you with your partners like you're, you know, having some handshake afterwards, like ruining the intimacy to say, thanks, I really appreciated that.
No, and it's funny. I've had people ask me why I say thank you even after a hug or a kiss, and it's because I liked it, and it's just merely good etiquette, I think. And also, like I said, just makes it a little bit more thoughtful and lets the other person know that, yes, what you did was great. Thank you.
Mike, I appreciate hearing that. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Gail from Elizabethtown, New York says, I'm 72. We didn't talk like this when I was young. I wish we did. We should talk as much as possible about these things. Thanks for sharing that, Gail. We also got a note from somebody posting as APRAX who said, the big issue on college campuses revolves around when someone is too drunk to consent. And what about when both people are drunk or too drunk to consent? Shouldn't they be charged with assaulting each other? Right now, it's always the man who's charged with rape or assault. Why? Kathleen, you want to address that?
Yeah, this is a big issue, and I think it's important that we address it. Alcohol is a social lubricant for many people. It's a reality on college campuses. If we don't talk about it, then we're not really getting at the heart of the issue. For me, the line is, I think about drunk driving. You know, there actually is a measure for when you're sober enough to drive and when you're not sober enough to drive. And we don't have that when it comes to sex. But we know that people sometimes have one or two drinks before they have sex. So in my mind, a good guideline is if you're too drunk to drive a car, you're too drunk to have sex. You know, how the law sees that and how it plays out in a court of law is a whole other matter. But I also appreciate the comment that in those cases where both parties are under the influence, going to that cultural norm, that assumption that the it, assuming it's heterosexual encounter that the man was the aggressor is I think problematic and something that we need to continue to address and to look at.
Kay, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to recognize that anyone can violate anyone's consent. And I think women, you know, women especially are taught to not ask for it, like we discussed earlier. And so we sometimes don't even know. And men are often taught to just go along with it because, of course, they want sex as far as, you know, they've been, you know, socialized to believe so or socialized to feel like they have to play that out. So, yeah, I think that's a really important part. And I think when alcohol is involved, it gets really fuzzy really fast.
And not just alcohol. We're now having conversations. I read a Vice article last night about what constitutes consent if you're stoned. If you're, you know, if there are other substances that you're using, how do you figure out where that line is? And it's a really tricky one.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic. And I think what was interesting particularly about that article is they weren't really able to cite any cases of just marijuana as a drug that was tied to a rape. It was always in combination with other things. And I think that's where a lot of the risk does come in. Although definitely for many people, you know, it's going to be the same as alcohol. It's very, very body dependent, I think.
Let's go to Hannah in Burlington. Hi, Hannah. Go right ahead.
I have a nephew, and ever since he was a newborn baby, we would always ask him, can I pick you up? Mm-hmm. Can I touch you here? Or we need to change your diaper. Can we? And it would be a conversation and a negotiation with him to discuss what needed to happen when. And unless something was unsafe, we would run and grab him, like if he's running into the road, and say, that's unsafe, I'm picking you up now, to explain to him why we had to pick him up or touch him. And now as a two-year-old, we've been doing that the entire time since he was a newborn. Now as a two-year-old, he is extremely clear about when he wants to play and when he wants to be touched and if he wants to be tickled. And I 100% agree that it is so critical, even as a newborn baby who can't verbalize, babies have body language. So I think if you pay attention to their body language, you can teach consent even to a newborn.
Hannah, thanks for your comment. Appreciate that. You know, talking really about how you start to address this concept of consent even before sex is an issue or sex is appropriate to be talking about with your children. Appreciate hearing that. And let's go to Andrea in Brattleboro. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Jane. About 30 years ago, a previous marriage, I had a disabling condition that would come and go. And my husband at the time decided that he was in the mood and he raped me. And it didn't happen just once. It happened many times. And when I finally got into the position where I realized that this was not good and I had said no when he initiated. And when I divorced him and I had gone to an attorney to talk about it, the attorney at the time told me that, well, that's he said, she said situation, and you were married, and it's going to be very hard to prove. And she basically just kind of washed it away and didn't even refer me to any kind of counseling as far as being raped or anything like that. And I had to initiate my own recovery from that trauma. And there are times that it still comes into my mind.
Andrea, I'm very sorry for your experiences, and I appreciate you sharing them and really addressing this topic that we've heard about in a couple different ways as we've discussed this, the idea of can you be raped in marriage, and to this idea of consent. Is there value in a long-term partnership in continuing to ask for and to give consent, and can you make that part of your sexual practices in a sexual partnership? So again, I'm very sorry to hear about your experience, and I appreciate you illuminating that idea of rape inside of a marriage. Okay, we just have a couple seconds left, but as we go out into the world armed with our new knowledge about the value of consent, any other tips for how to gracefully give or accept a no or a yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, you can always say something along the lines of, I'd really like to do that with you another day. I would really prefer to do this other activity. And hearing no's, you know, I think it's really important to acknowledge the no, and you can acknowledge how you're feeling without guilting somebody. But just acknowledge the no and often thank people for being comfortable to share. Somebody being willing to say no with you is a huge sign of trust. And that's something that I didn't learn until, you know, I had a hard time saying no when I was younger, because it wasn't even that I didn't think it would be respected so much as it would just make me a bad person or a tease, or I didn't have the right to. And a no takes a lot of trust.
That's a good way to end it. A no takes a lot of trust. So work on saying no if that's how you feel. Kay Berto is a freelance writer for Bustle. Kathleen Barkley is executive director of HopeWorks, an organization that provides crisis counseling and advocacy for people affected by sexual violence. Thank you both very much for being here for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having us.